You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2015 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. You are going to meet some exceptional people tonight who are here in person, all except for one, Mahamadou Oul Salaki, the author of tonight's book, The Guantanamo Diary, who has been held in American custody for 12 years, the past 12 years, without having been charged with a crime. His book, the first by a present-day Guantanamo detainee, comes to us heavily censored after years of litigation by his lawyers. What does one feel after reading this book? Have any of you read it already? Have any of you read it? Some of you have read it. I felt many emotions, conflicting ones, sadness, shame, and yet wonder. Wonder at sadness and shame that our government has perpetrated this injustice, and wonder at the resilience of the human spirit, specifically that of Mr. Salaki. He's a remarkable individual. In last week's State of the Union address, President Obama renewed his pledge to close Guantanamo before leaving office, and the recent attacks, perhaps in Paris, have renewed the anxieties that have kept the prison going for so long. But the response to the Guantanamo Diary from book critics and from readers worldwide has been passionate. It's a book that stirs one's conscience, and we hope that it will be a tool in helping to end this chapter in American history. Our distinguished guests tonight, and we're very lucky to have them here, fresh from the non-blizzard in New York, they barely made it out, include Larry Seams, who edited the Guantanamo Diary. Larry is a longtime human rights activist. Many of you here know him perhaps from his years working as Freedom to Write director for Penn, both in Los Angeles and New York. He's the author of two books, Between the Lines, Letters Between Undocumented Mexican and Central American Immigrants and Their Families and Friends, and The Torture Report, What the Documents Say About America's Post-9/11 Torture Program. And Nancy Hollander is an internationally recognized criminal defense lawyer. She has argued and won a case involving religious freedom in the United States Supreme Court. She is the lead counsel for Chelsea Manning on appeal, and she represents two prisoners at Guantanamo, including Mahamadou Salaki, and we're eager to hear about her efforts on his behalf. Erwin Chemerinsky, who will be moderating tonight, is the founding dean of the University of California Irvine School of Law and a good friend of the Library Foundation. He's authored 8 books, most recently The Case Against the Supreme Court, and he's argued several cases before the Supreme Court and various circuits of the United States Court of Appeal, and he also represents a detainee at Guantanamo. We're going to open tonight with a reading from the Guantanamo Diary by award-winning actor-filmmaker Reza Safai, whose latest film is A Girl Walks Home at Night. So please welcome our distinguished guests, and we will begin with the reading. Thank you so much.
When I arrived at my mom's home around 4 p.m., only my redacted and my sister redacted were there, and both were asleep. My mom had gone outside to gather her scattered sheep. It was feeding time. I went inside the house and put on my bathrobe. On my way to the shower, my mom and two secret police guys surged almost simultaneously into the house. Salahi, the director general wants to see you. Why? We don't know, said one of the guys. Okay. I'm going to take a shower and change my clothes. Okay, said the guy, stepping out. We're going to wait on you outside. The secret police respected me highly since I turned myself in a couple of weeks ago. They knew I am not a person who flees. I had basically been under house arrest since 2000, but I could have fled the country any time. I didn't. I didn't have any reason to. I took my shower and changed. In the meantime, my aunt woke up because of the noise. My sister didn't wake up, as far as I remember, and that was good because I was only worried about her and the extreme depression she had been suffering. I think the police called you because you bought a new TV and they don't want you to watch TV, don't you think? Said my mom innocently. I smiled and said, I don't think so, but everything is going to be all right. My mom was referring to the new satellite antenna I installed the night before to have better TV reception. The irony is that the redacted was the one who helped me install the antenna. When I was in prison the month before, he had asked me to find a job for him because the police paid him miserably. I promised him I would, and in the meantime, I wanted to offer him an opportunity to do some work for me. So I called him to help fix my antenna and paid him adequately. That was the only way for a man like him to survive. I helped him to get some work, and we were sipping tea and joking in my house. I didn't bring you to my house to arrest me, I said jokingly. I hope you will never be arrested, Redacted said. My mom's house is next to my brother's, with a short wall that separates them. I could simply have jumped to my brother's house and escaped through his door that opens to a completely other street. And guess what? There would be no finding me, not only because so many people would shelter me, but also because the police agents would not have been interested in finding me. I even believe that the government would have been much happier saying to the U.S., he fled, we couldn't find him. The secret police agents obviously wanted me to flee, especially Redacted. But I wanted to keep it real, not to mention that the government itself assured my family that I had done nothing, and so my family always wanted me to go to the police whenever they asked to see me. The funny thing about secret police in Arab countries is that they are more known to the commoners than the regular police forces. I think the authorities in Arabic countries should think about a new nomenclature, something like the most obvious police. There were four of them when I stepped outside the door with my mom and my aunt. My mom kept her composure and started to pray, using her fingers. As to my aunt, that was her first time seeing somebody taken by the police, and so she got crippled and couldn't say a word. She started to sweat heavily and mumbled some prayers. Both kept their eyes staring at me. It is the taste of helplessness when you see your beloved fading away like a dream and you cannot help him. And same for me. I would watch both my mom and my aunt praying in my rearview mirror until we took the first turn and I saw my beloved ones disappear. Take your car. We hope you can come back home today, one of the guys had instructed me. The DG might ask you some questions. Redacted occupied my passenger seat, as sad as he could be. Salahi, I wish I were not part of this shit. Over the next several days, I almost lost my mind. Their recipe for me went like this. I must be kidnapped from Redacted and put in a secret place. I must be made to believe I was on a far, far away island. I must be informed by Redacted that my mom was captured and put in a special facility. In the secret place, the physical and psychological suffering must be at their highest extremes. I must not know the difference between day and night. I couldn't tell a thing about days going by or time passing. My time consisted of crazy darkness all the time. My diet times were deliberately messed up. I was starved for long periods and then given food, but not given time to eat. You have 3 minutes, eat, a guard would yell at me. And then after about half a minute, he would grab the plate, you're done. And then it was the opposite extreme. I was given too much food, and a guard came into my cell and forced me to eat all of it. When I said, I need water, because the food got stuck in my throat, he punished me by making me drink 2 25-ounce water bottles. I can't drink, I said when my abdomen felt as if it were going to explode. But Redacted screamed and threatened me, pushing me against the wall and raising his hand to hit me. I figured drinking would be better, and I drank until I vomited. All the guards were masked with Halloween-like masks, and so were the medics, and the guards were briefed that I was a high-level, smart-beyond-belief terrorist. You know who you are, said Redacted's friend. You're a terrorist who helped kill 3,000 people. Indeed I am, I answered. I realized it was futile to discuss my case with a guard, especially when he knew nothing about me. The guards were all very hostile. They cursed, shouted, and constantly put me through military-like basic training. Get up! Walk to the bin hole! Stop! Grab the shit! Eat! You got 2 minutes! You're done! Give the shit back! Drink! You better drink the whole water bottle! Hurry up! Sit down! Don't sit unless I say it! Search the piece of shit! Most of the guards rarely attacked me physically, but Redacted hit me once until I fell face down on the floor, and whenever he and his associate grabbed me, they held me very tight and made me run in the heavy chains. Move! No sleep was allowed. In order to enforce this, I was given 25-ounce water bottles in intervals of 1 to 2 hours, depending on the mood of the guards, 24 hours a day. The consequences were devastating. I couldn't close my eyes for 10 minutes because I was sitting most of the time on the bathroom. Later on, after the tension was relieved, I asked one of the guards, "Why the water diet? Why don't you just make me stay awake by standing up like in Redacted?" Psychologically, it's devastating to make somebody stay awake on his own without ordering him, he said. Redacted. Believe me, you haven't seen anything. We have put detainees naked under the shower for days, eating, pissing, and shitting in the shower, he continued. Other guards told me about other torture methods that I wasn't really eager to know about. I was allowed to say 3 sentences. Yes, sir, need my interrogator, and need the medics. Every once in a while, the whole guard team stormed my cell, dragged me out, put me facing the wall, and threw out whatever was in my cell, shouting and cursing in order to humiliate me. It wasn't much. I was deprived from all comfort items that a detainee needs, except for a mattress and a small, thin, worn-out blanket. For the first weeks, I also had no shower, no laundry, no brushing. I almost developed bugs. I hated my smell. No sleep. Water diet. Every move behind my door made me stand up in a military-like position with my heart pounding like boiling water. My appetite was non-existent. I was waiting every minute on the next session of torture. I hoped I would die and go to heaven. No matter how sinful I am, these people can never be more merciful than God. Ultimately, we all are going to face the Lord and beg for his mercy, admitting our weaknesses and our sinfulness. I could hardly remember any prayers. All I could say was, "Please, God, relieve my pain." I started to hallucinate and hear voices as clear as crystal. I heard my family in a casual, familiar conversation that I couldn't join. I heard Quran readings in a heavenly voice. I heard music from my country. Later on, the guards used these hallucinations and started talking with funny voices through the plumbing, encouraging me to hurt the guards and plot an escape. But I wasn't misled by them, even though I played along. "We hurt somebody, maybe a genie," they used to say. "Yeah, but I ain't listening to him," I responded. I just realized I was on the edge of losing my mind. I started to talk to myself. Although I tried as hard as I could to convince myself that I was not in Mauritania, I was not near my family, so I could not possibly hear them speaking. I kept hearing the voices constantly, day and night. Lonely in my cell, I was terrified when I heard the guards carrying the heavy chains and shouting at my door, "Reservation!" My heart started to pound heavily because I always expected the worst. But the fact that I wasn't allowed to see the light made me enjoy the short trip between my freaking cold cell and the interrogation room. It was just a blessing when the warm Gitmo sun hit me. I would always get this fake happiness, though only for a very short time. It's like taking narcotics. "How you been?" said one of the Puerto Rican escorting guards in his weak English. "I'm okay. Thanks. And you?" "No worry. You're going to go back to your family," he said. When he said that, I couldn't help breaking in. Redacted. Lately, I'd become so vulnerable. What was wrong with me? Just one soothing word in this ocean of agony was enough to make me cry. Redacted. We had a complete Puerto Rican division. They were different than other Americans. They were not as vigilant and unfriendly. Sometimes they took detainees to a shower, Redacted. Everybody liked them, but they got in trouble with those responsible for the camps because of their friendly and humane approach to detainees. I can't objectively speak about the people from Puerto Rico because I haven't met enough. However, if you ask me, have you ever seen a bad Puerto Rican guy? My answer would be no.
privileged to be here to talk about a stunning, magnificent book, Guantanamo Diary. Over Martin Luther King Day weekend in January of 2002, there were the first reports of individuals being brought to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The reports were of individuals being brought in shackles, blindfolded, and drugged. The barracks weren't ready yet in Guantanamo, so they were literally housed in 8-foot by 8-foot cages. This is the diary of one of these individuals. He taught himself English, his fourth language. He wrote this diary in 2005. As we sit here in January 2015, he remains in Guantanamo. I think the place to start the conversation is by asking you, Larry, how did you get involved in this project? You mentioned the book. You've still never met him.
I haven't met him. It's very strange. I actually came to Mohamedou's story through a different set of documents completely, the U.S. government's documents that record what happened to him in Guantanamo. Between 2009 and 2012, I was working on a project called the Torture Report with the ACLU, which the ACLU had excavated about 100,000 pages of government documents through Freedom of Information Act litigation. And it was about, you know, it was documents relating to prisoner abuse in Guantanamo, Afghanistan, and Iraq. And my job was to kind of go through these documents and stitch together narratives, find characters to sort of help guide readers through these heavily redacted documents. And one of the characters that stands out is Mohamedou Ould-Slahi, because his torture was one of the most well-documented in Guantanamo. He was one of two detainees who were designated for what they called a special project interrogation by defense intelligence interrogators. He had an interrogation plan that went through several drafts that was signed off on all the way up to the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld. And it was implemented in exceedingly deliberate and kind of stubborn and brutal fashion over a year. And then in the way of bizarre way of all torturers, you know, they recorded very accurately what they did to him every day. And we had those documents. So I knew that story, and it was a really quite shocking story. And then as I was working on it, in 2010, we got another amazing document, which was the decision of the U.S. District Court judge who heard his habeas corpus case and ordered him released. And that document also corroborated this mistreatment, but it also made clear how thin, in fact, non-existent the government's case against him was. And then finally, the other thing was, you know, I had in those documents just little snippets of Mohamedou's voice. So I had a sense that this was a rather an interesting character. We had the transcripts from his detainee review boards in 2004 and 2005. And in those, he would say things like he was describing this masked interrogator, which a guy who's known in the government documents as Mr. X. He wears a balaclava and black. And he says, you know, he was covered in black, completely in black, like the women in Saudi Arabia. And he had gloves, O.J. Simpson gloves on his hands, you know. And there's a letter to one of Nancy's partners on the legal team, the attorney Sylvia Royce. He writes to Sylvia, who said, you asked me to write about all of my interrogations. You might as well ask Charlie Sheen how many women he's dated. You know, so you had a sense that this guy had an extraordinary voice. And in the 2005 detainee review board hearing, you know, he's telling his story. In fact, he's telling the story of his abuse. And quite shockingly, in the transcript, suddenly, as he's telling the story of this boat trip, which I'm sure we'll talk about tonight, suddenly the transcript is interrupted, and in boldface type, it says that the recording equipment failed for about, you know, several minutes while he's telling this story. But he comes back and finally says, I just want to mention that I wrote a book recently while in jail here about my whole story, okay? I sent it for release to the District of Columbia, and when it is released, I advise you to read it. It's a very interesting book, I think. So I knew that this was out there, and in the summer of 2012, I got a call from Nancy's team saying that they had finally got this manuscript, which had been locked away for 7 years, declassified.
Well, Nancy, let me ask you, how did you begin representing him?
Well, in 2005, I was actually kind of looking for someone to represent in Guantanamo. And there was another prisoner who I had talked to his military lawyer, and then that prisoner didn't want any counsel. And then just out of the blue, I got an email from a lawyer in France who I had met through some international teaching, a man named Emmanuel Altied. And the email said that he had received a request from a lawyer in Mauritania named Mr. Ibete that the family of this particular person who turned out to be Mohamedou was looking for him, and they believed he was in Guantanamo. And could I find out? And I found out, and I wrote back and said yes. And he said, well, let's represent him. And I said, okay. Of course, Emmanuel couldn't represent him because you had to have a security clearance to go to Guantanamo. So he never did, and over the years, we developed a team. But what I learned was that another lawyer, that the Center for Constitutional Rights had actually recruited a lot of lawyers just to represent the prisoners without knowing them, and they were just assigning lawyers. And they had assigned this lawyer, Sylvia Royce, to Mohamedou because she spoke French and because it was a thought that he probably spoke French since Mauritania had been a French colony, and that way she wouldn't need an interpreter. And I contacted her, excuse me, and she said, well, maybe since the family wanted me, I should take over, and we decided to both go. This was at the very beginning, and it was our first trip. And I wrote to Mohamedou and told him we were coming, but I had no way of knowing whether he ever received the letter. So we go down there, and Guantanamo then was not nearly as organized as it is now. But we got there, and the guards took us into the hut that they were using for interviews. And he stood up, and he stood up and he smiled, and I'll just never forget it. He smiled and he put his arms out as though to embrace us, and we waited for him to walk to us. And then we realized he couldn't move because he was shackled to the floor with shackles on his ankles to an eye bolt. So we walked to him, and he embraced us. And we just stood there as the first people he had really touched, other than his guards, in 4 years. And he gave us, he had written, the guards had given him a notebook, and he had filled it. And he gave it to us so we would know something about him. And that was the beginning of this book. That was 90 pages about his history and his background and some of the torture. And later on, he developed it more. But that was the beginning. And then he continued to write over the rest of the year. And that became the book.
Talk about him. Describe him physically, personality, the life that he had before he gets taken to Jordan and then to Guantanamo.
He's fairly small. He's not much bigger than I am. He's now quite thin, and he's always been thin. He's got a beautiful smile, if you see a picture of him, beautiful teeth, long, thin hands. He has a lot of expression when he talks. He uses his hands a lot. And he's a funny guy. I mean, as you heard from Larry, he makes a lot of jokes. He's very, very smart. English is his fourth language. He speaks, reads, and writes in English, French, German, and Arabic. And French, German, and Arabic were before he even came. He grew up in a very poor family in Mauritania. But as a young teenager, he won a scholarship to Germany. There were, I believe, two people that year in Mauritania, and it was a full scholarship, and so he went to Germany and ultimately became an electrical engineer. And that's where he learned German, obviously. So he left Mauritania, and the idea was that he would be the person who would support the law, big extended family, because he was, of course, the first one to get educated. But there was a diversion, and that was in about 1990 when the Afghanis were fighting against the Soviets and the communist-controlled government in Afghanistan. And Muslim young men were recruited from all over the world, including in the United States, to go and fight. And he went. And the government has seized on this as he swore allegiance to Al-Qaeda. Well, that's true. But in my view, I think so did we. I mean, the United States supported that war with millions and millions of dollars of armaments and money, and that's all public now, and everybody's seen the movie Charlie Wilson's War, and we all know about how the right wing of this country really was tremendous support of that. And he went there, and when that ended, when the communist government fell, he left and never went back. But that's what the government has seized on to this day, and that's really all they have on him.
Well, that's my question. Larry, why is he in Guantanamo? And he tells a story. Do you believe his explanation for why he's in Guantanamo?
Well, there's an ever-shifting explanations for why he's in Guantanamo. I mean, I think that's the most important place to start. You know, he reported, as the reading at the beginning made clear, he voluntarily reported to the National Police Headquarters in Nouakchott, Mauritania, for questioning. He had been questioned before, even before 9/11, because he lived briefly in Montreal. He attended the same mosque as Ahmad Rassam, who's the Millennium Bomber. And everybody who attended that mosque came under suspicion. Shortly after that, he just got fed up with that kind of surveillance and life and went back to Mauritania. We had questioned him when he returned to Senegal. He flew from Montreal to, you know, through Europe to Senegal. The FBI actually questioned him there, put him on a plane, flew him back to Mauritania. They held him, questioned him there, released him. And then he lived for a year and a half in Mauritania, working as an electrical engineer. Worked for a company. The day that he reported for questioning, the scene at the beginning of the readings, he was in the presidential palace that morning, submitting a bid for a new telecom system for the presidential palace. That was his life. He lived in this, you know, compound with his family, and he was just living and working, and they called him and said, well, we want to ask you more questions. It was after 9/11 now, they were asking everybody. So, you know, he reported, they told him he would be home, but instead the United States got the Jordanian government to send a rendition plane, picked him up, sent him to Jordan. The Jordanians questioned him for about 7 months about the Millennium Plot.
Can I interject here? As I understand, his family didn't know where he was, and for about a year, his family kept bringing money and things to the prison for him with no one telling the family that he'd actually been taken to Jordan.
This is actually a really shocking story, and there's a lot of aspects of this story that are shocking. We know this because of his brother, Yadi. Yadi, who lives in Germany, followed Mohamedou's footsteps and became sort of the next breadwinner for the family. I met him about a year ago. I went and visited him, and he told me this story. And there is, to this day, no American journalist or media organization has interviewed Yadi. He's been in Germany. He's been very public, part of a campaign for his brother. But, you know, the American media never even bothered to think about what the human consequences of these detentions are for their families, and he's there and accessible. So Yadi told me the story. He Mohamedou went to the prison. We spirited him away to Jordan. That entire time, for an entire year, his family was bringing food, clothing, to the prison every day for him for a year. And then Yadi picked up Der Spiegel in October of 2002, almost a year later, and read an article that his brother was in Guantanamo. And he was so angry, not at the United States, but at the Mauritanian government and the local police for ripping off the family, you know. And he called his family. He said, you know, you won't believe this. Mohamedou's, and the family panicked. You know, they assumed their lines were tapped and they hung up on him. And he called again and they hung up on him again. And just to give you a sense of, you know, what a wrenching experience this must have been for his family. So he was interrogated in Jordan for 7 months. The Jordanians concluded he had nothing to do with the Millennium Plot. So now we're in the summer.
I want to pause before we leave the Jordanian. When you say interrogated, it sounds much more humane than the book describes it as being. What was done to him in Jordan was torture.
Well, we don't know a lot about what happened to him in Jordan. There have been no public statements about it. His description, and in the book, is that they hit him a little bit, but most of what they did was make him listen to other people screaming. And that just terrorized him. And, of course, we have no way of knowing whether these were real people, whether they were playing the sounds of people, which, of course, we know that torturers have done in the past. But he was terrified. They also would hide him because the Red Cross would come once every 2 weeks. The International Red Cross, the ICRC, would come once every 2 weeks to check on all the prisoners in the Jordanian prison. And all of a sudden, Mohamedou would find himself in this solitary cell, kind of in the basement. And he hadn't done anything wrong. It wasn't like he was being punished. But he discovered that that's where they put him whenever the Red Cross came, so they wouldn't know he was here, there. So he was completely hidden away and terrorized and had no idea what was going to happen next.
And I cut you all off, Larry. You were saying after 7 months, he's then taken from Jordan to Guantanamo.
Well, so after 7 months, and the Jordanians clearly concluded that he was had no connection to the Millennium Plot, and they were ready to send him home. But, you know, and this is where I think, you know, as I sort of worked, pieced my way through this story, I think this is like a crucial moment in the story that's worth exploring. You know, this is the summer of 2002. Nobody knew that the CIA was renditioning people to other countries, you know, that we were asking the Jordanian government, essentially. And it turns out Human Rights Watch did a report. There were 15 detainees who were held in the same prisoners. I shouldn't use the word detainees, prisoners, who were held at the same facility in Jordan where he was held at the request of the CIA, tortured or questioned at the request of the CIA. But nobody knew that in the summer of 2002. The president of Mauritania was a key ally of the United States in a war on terror. He was in a very shaky political position. He eventually was toppled in a coup 2 years later. So clearly the CIA must have decided they couldn't send him home. They couldn't release him. And so they just dumped him on the military. And in fact, in the CIA report that just came out, the Senate report on CIA, there's another similar case where they describe somebody who was in CIA detention who they realized fairly soon was not anybody, and they ended up, they didn't release him, they sent him over to the military, and the military held him for 3.5 more years because they just didn't want to let him go at that point. So anyway, so Mohamedou, they send a rendition plane, pick him up in Jordan, send him to Bagram, he's held there for 2 weeks, and then from Bagram to Guantanamo. And he arrives in August of 2002. Guantanamo has now been open about 7 months. August is a key month because in August of 2002, by that time, the U.S. government knows that basically Guantanamo is filled with nobodies. That month, the CIA does an audit inside of the prison. And they come back and they say, you know, you have a lot of farmers here, a lot of just people who are sold, you know, wrong place, wrong time. And instead of dealing with that situation, the military decides to kind of double down and go for these enhanced interrogations. So Mohamedou arrives just at this moment of this great tug of war between the FBI and criminal investigation task force interrogators who favor rapport building interrogations and this new defense intelligence agency team, special projects team that's been set up that's importing these enhanced interrogations, and they just decide that they're going to go at these two prisoners. They go, the first one is a guy named Mohamed Al-Qahtani, and they subject him again to a written interrogation plan that looks very much like this: extreme isolation, sleep deprivation, loud music, nudity, sexual humiliation. And then they turn the same thing loose on Mohamedou.
You call it enhanced interrogation, but that's really the euphemism the government wants to use.
Right.
It's
right.
Torture.
It's torture.
Clearly.
Do you want to talk about what was done to him?
Well, it's clearly torture. They started out, the FBI started out talking to him and doing what they do, which is getting to be friends and getting information. And then they told him that they were leaving, and that another team was coming in, and it wasn't going to be a good time. And they started first. They did a number of things. They made his where he lived, his cell, they blackened it all or whited it all, whichever they did, but they cut out all the light and everything, so he couldn't see anything. And then they just started interrogating him for 20 hours a day. And they had something called the Frequent Flyer Program. And that was where, and you heard it in described, he would be interrogated for 3 shifts and then not allowed to sleep. So for 70 days, and actually there were 2 blocks of 70 days, he didn't sleep more than 2 hours at a time. And this makes you go pretty nuts pretty fast. They also knew that he had a back injury from before, and it was in his medical records, and they had access to his medical records. So they also had access to his records of talking to the psychologist. So they knew two things about him that were important. They knew he had a back injury, and they knew he was very close to his mother. And they used both of those things against him. They put him in stress positions that were very painful for him. They turned down the heat so he was in a very cold room. Then they would turn it up so it was very hot. And then they planned this whole event. And the event was that he was talking to an interrogator, and all of a sudden they came in, black masks, and with a dog, and they hit him. We have his medical records. They did break his ribs, just as he describes. They dragged him to a boat and led him to believe that he was going to be executed or taken to some other country, and dragged him around on this boat, made him drink salt water, and he was hooded so he couldn't see, but they had earmuffs on, but they made it intentionally so he could hear a Jordanian and an Egyptian talking to each other in a pre-planned conversation. And Arabic is a language where an Arabic speaker can really identify where someone is from. So he knew one was an Egyptian and one was a Jordanian. And they had this conversation, well, we'll take him to Egypt, you know what we do to people there. Well, we'll take him to Jordan, you know what we do to people there. Just to terrorize him. And then every once in a while they would just hit him. And he's blindfolded, so he never knew when it was coming, and so he lived in constant terror. And ultimately, they took him off the boat, they put him back, and led him to believe he was in another country. And then this just went on and on for months and months of interrogations. And he describes them all in the book. But to me, one of the worst things they did, and for him, one of the worst things, was they brought in someone who came in and pretended to be from the White House with a fake letter. And he said, we have instructions, we have arrested your mother, and we're bringing her to Guantanamo. How do you think she'll do here with all these men? We'll do our best to protect her. It was a complete fake. By the way, also a complete violation of the Geneva Conventions to do that. And yet, that's what really was it for him. That was the worst, I think, of all the things they did, that was the worst thing that they did. And this just went on forever.
So much of what's described that was done to him can only be depicted with the word depraved. One thing that seemed particularly depraved as I was reading the book was the way in which they used sexual humiliation as a form of torture. I don't know if you want to mention that.
Well, it is a remarkable scene, and in which one of his interrogators, and then she's joined on a subsequent day by a partner, take off their uniform tops and, you know, sexually molest him and verbally humiliate him for a period of 10 hours. Again, we've known that this happened. There was a New York Times editorial as early as 2005 when the Schmidt-Furlow report was released that, you know, specifically denounced the use of female interrogators. I mean, the fact that we're putting, you know, American servicewomen in this position of asking them to do these things. I mean, it's really worth underscoring here. You know, Mohamedou says early, and that's at one point in the book, I've tried to record my experience. I've tried neither to exaggerate nor to understate. And, you know, there was a sort of an interesting process that I went through as I was editing this book of, you know, coming to trust him as a writer. You know, I don't know him. I have been allowed no contact with him. But, you know, the first thing that strikes you is his incredible accuracy in describing what happened to him. And we know, we have the memoranda for the record of his interrogators, which are just a daily sort of account of what they did. And the Senate Armed Services Committee report has, you know, you can see when these things happen. So, for instance, Mohamedou describes Mr. X, this hooded interrogator, putting him in a room, turning on the strobe lights, and putting on let the bodies hit the floor at full volume. And he describes it at a date, and it corresponds exactly to the date that's in the record. So, you know, the ordeal that he describes, if anything, I think he understates. I think he's wrong. I think he does understate, because there are, you know, parts of the sexual humiliation that are in the documentary record that he just doesn't want to talk about, because he just thinks it's awful and disgusting that somebody did that, you know? So, but, you know, a couple of notes about how the business of trusting him. It was such an amazing process, because there was always one more level of truth that he was operating on than I was operating on. I was just moving forward. And here's just two kind of amusing examples. One was, at one point he describes seeing a friend of his that they're asking him when he's, you know, making him give testimonies against other people, seeing this guy that he knows in a prison jumpsuit. And he says, and whenever you see a guy in one of those Bob Barker, Calvin Klein jumpsuits, you know he's not having fun. And I'm like, I sort of, like, Calvin Klein, I got. Bob Barker seemed like a kind of a weird cultural reference. But I kind of, like, I realized that I didn't dig enough, but, when I brought the draft of the edit to my first editor, this guy, great guy, Jeff Chandler at Little Brown, you know, Jeff said, well, what does he mean, Bob Barker? And I said, I don't know. For some reason, he's Bob Barker. Why? I don't know. I'll figure it out. And Jeff says, hang on a second. And he turns and he Googles. And Bob Barker Incorporated is the largest manufacturer of prison jumpsuits in the United States. And they're the prison supplier to Guantanamo. And it's like, okay, I should have known better. I should have known to trust him. And then another one, not quite so amusing, is during this scene of sexual humiliation, at one point, he's refusing to eat. It seems like a logical thing to do, at least try to maintain some control over your own body. And one of his interrogators says, and this is the way he writes it, his interrogator says, you won't starve. We're going to feed you up to your ass. And so there's that extra two in there. And Mohamedou has a lot of amusing passages in the book about English and what a crazy, ridiculous language it is. And one of them is specifically about how difficult prepositions were. So I just assumed that was a superfluous too. And so we ran excerpts in Slate in 2013, and I had a debate with the editor of Slate about that too. And he said, you know, I said, the guy must be saying, we're just going to feed you up your ass. And he said, no. He said, that too might be, it might just be like some kind of metaphorical level, like how much we're going to feed you or something. But I said, come on, think about, I know guys who say, they're going to feed you up here. I just, like, that sounds like guys I know would talk like that. And so I sort of won that argument, but I never for a moment thought that there was such a practice as rectal feeding. And then just the, you know, past month, the CIA's report comes out, and we find out that, in fact, that was a literal threat that was being made to him. So, you know, it's just that process where, you know, even it just took me really two solid years of, you know, just at every moment when I was uncertain or I had a doubt, you know, I would discover something that showed that this man was telling the truth.
Nancy, the literature about torture says if a person is tortured long enough, they'll start talking, even to say untruthful things, just to say anything to try to get the torture to end. There's a point where that happens to Hamidou.
There is a point, and it's after the letter, the fake letter about his mother, that he tells the guards, I want to talk to my interrogators. And they bring the interrogators, and he says, I'll tell you anything you want. And they have him write, and they gave him a computer. They had him say everything he could. And he just started making up stuff, but basically using the information they were giving him, because they would tell him things that they believed he had done. You were involved in this. You were involved in this. And the example that I continue to use is one that he uses, and that is this. There's some kind of tower in Toronto, and they said, we know that you had planned to blow up the tower in Toronto. Well, he didn't. He said, I don't know. I didn't know anything about a tower in Toronto. But I said, yes, I did. And let me tell you all about it. And let me tell you all the people. And he tried to make enough depth that they would believe him. And ultimately, it all fell apart because he didn't do any of it. And they didn't really care. Which leads to another concern that's recently come out in some reports that maybe they weren't ever really looking for information. Maybe they were really just trying to figure out whether their methods worked and what their methods did. And there's reason to believe that that's true, and that we know that General Miller, who started in Guantanamo, then went to Abu Ghraib. And we know that then all of this went to the black sites. But they knew and they learned that he didn't know anything.
There's actually an extraordinary bit of new information in the Senate Intelligence Committee's report about the CIA, in which the CIA, we have long been told the interrogation of Abu Zubaydah was, you know, driven by the certainty that Abu Zubaydah knew something, mm-hmm. and they were trying to get it out. As it's described in the CIA's documents at the time in that are now in this new Senate Intelligence Report, in fact, the CIA was doing that excessive waterboarding until it was satisfied that he didn't know the things that they thought he knew.
Right.
You know, and that's a you know, in other words, there wasn't information there that they wanted. They just were satisfying themselves that he didn't know what they thought maybe he would know. And that's quite perverse.
It's interesting. I had a different sense as I was reading the book, though. I had the sense that there was a serious suspicion about him. It was a shifting suspicion. Donald Rumsfeld himself approved the interrogation plan for Hamidou. And my sense was they kept escalating the torture in an effort to get him to talk, but if he had nothing to say, then it would produce nothing until he finally caved. Is that a misapprehension of what occurred?
I think there's truth to that. I think that after they figured out that he had nothing to do with the Millennium plot, Ahmed Rassam, who was convicted of that, laid out people. I mean, he talked about 150 people all over the world and specifically was asked about Mohamedou and said he didn't know him. So they knew before he even got to Guantanamo that he wasn't involved in that. But then they thought he was one of the recruiters for the pilots for 9/11. And for a while, they were really convinced of that. They had convinced themselves that that must be because he was in Germany when Ramzi Ben Ashiba was there, and he had a cousin named Abu Hafsa Moratani who was close to Osama bin Laden. So he must be the link. And they just kept pushing and pushing and pushing. And ultimately, they realized that wasn't true. And in 2010, when we finally had the hearing, the government admitted that Mohamedou probably didn't even know when anything about 9/11. But they did. They kept pushing and pushing, thinking if we keep torturing him, he'll finally admit to what we want him to say. We just want him to say, and he describes one of the interrogators saying, "We know what you did. We just want you to say it." And, you know, so he said it. He said it about everything he could think of.
As for any prisoner, and especially one in these circumstances, the guards are enormously important. And a great deal of this book is talking about the guards. What I found interesting was some of the guards are brutal sadists imaginable, but some are very humane and compassionate. He's taught to play chess. He talks about watching movies with the guards. Do you have a sense of his relationship with the guards and how it plays out in this book?
Well, I think this is the really astonishing thing about this book, you know, is that you realize, you know, the curtain that's been drawn on Guantanamo is one that's prohibited us from seeing the human lives that are lived out there. And many of those lives are our own brothers and sisters, our own, you know, American servicemen and women, intelligence agents. And for the first time in this book, we get portraits of ourselves and many of them. And as you say, they're rich and complex. He has a very deliberate and, you know, an admirable writerly ethic of treating every character as an individual. You know, he insists, you know, everybody is a combination of good and bad. The only question is what's the percentage, you know? And he's really careful to, you know, to track even character development and characters who are brutal at one point come back later And are repentant in a way. And so it's that look. I mean, it's interesting because you mentioned that, you know, that even the torture, in some ways, he's quite sympathetic to the dilemma of his interrogators. You know, he describes his interrogators day after day being thrown into these interrogation rooms saying, these guys are the worst of the worst, go get what they know. They don't know anything. You know, these guys are ill-equipped, they don't, you know, and just so that kind of endless drama, feudal drama. And so, you know, I think that's, I think one of the most amazing things about the book is his, you know, he's, as Nancy said, obviously a very social person. He develops community wherever he is. You know, and his journey takes him through this kind of global gulag of intelligence prisons, right? He's in Senegal, Mauritania, Amman, Jordan, Bagram, they all have guards. He interacts with the guard. They all have the same class system, mm-hmm. you know? And so it's this kind of amazing, you know, it moves you into prison literature and the way that, you know, prisons are human communities, these stratified communities, and there's this kind of class relationship. And, you know, and these incredible relationships develop with his guards, a couple of really poignant scenes, one where, you know, he finally has a conversation with a guard who, you know, why did you prevent me from praying? That's illegal. Why would you do that? And the guard said, I know it was an illegal order. I know it's a terrible thing to do. I had to do it because they would have given me a shitty job, the guard says. That's why I did it. But I know I'll go to hell for what I did to you, one of his guards tells him. And then there's an amazing scene at the end of the book where they bring in a new guard crew that's clearly brought in to rehabilitate him, to bring him back from the edge. And these guards, one of them brings his mattress over in front of Mohamedou's cell, and they talked all night about politics and women and everything over the course of weeks. And when this guard crew leaves, they give Mohamedou, as a parting gift, a copy of Steve Martin's The Pleasure of My Company, which I think is a joke based on probably Mohamedou's attitude toward them, you know, and they signed the book, and they dedicate it all, and his nickname is Pillow. This is what the guards call him, and they call him Pillow because the first thing that he's allowed to have after months and months of total deprivation is a pillow. So his nickname is Pillow, and they all dedicate this book to him saying, you know, I think we became friends. And then, you know, Nancy, you can say what it is that he inscribed, you know, the sort of the end epigraph to the book, which he just wrote this year.
Well, you know, the pillow thing is also really interesting because when he got that pillow, he was so excited that he had had nothing to read for months and months. And you know how pillows say, you know, don't tear this thing off it. Something terrible will happen to you. Well, he kept reading it over and over and over because it was the first thing that he had to read, and he was so excited. And so some of the guards called him Pillow. And you know, I do want to talk about what he said at the end, but I've spent a lot of time down there over the last 10 years and long days with Mohamedou, and I've interacted with the guards who interact with him, and they, you know, they're all very respectful of him. He's very respectful of them. I remember even the very first time I went down, for some reason we needed to speak to the SJA, the military lawyer, about something. He had to bring us some documents, and he went out of his way to say to me, he said, you know, your client's very respectful. And he is to everyone, and even to the guards and the interrogators. During the worst of times, he's very respectful to them. But the book was written in 2005, 10 years ago. But at the end, we asked him if he wanted to write something now, and he wrote just a tiny thing at the end, and that was written in 2014, that he wrote to Linda Marino, one of the other lawyers, and he said that he hopes that someday he can sit down and have a cup of tea with the people in this book, and he hopes that they'll read it and tell him if he got anything wrong, and that he wants to meet with them because they've learned so much from each other. And he describes in the book that, you know, you don't get to choose your family. And he didn't get to choose this family, but they became his family, whether he liked it or not. You know, and there's some people in your family you don't like and some that you do like and some that are better than others. And that's who he is. He holds no grudge.
That leads to my question. We're both lawyers. We're not psychologists. But as I read the book, I wondered, how did he keep his humanity? I would imagine if any of us went through what he did, we become tremendously embittered. Maybe he doesn't go crazy. But he keeps humanity, and it comes through throughout this diary. Do you have a sense of how?
You know, over the last 10 years, there have been good times and not so good times, and I've seen him. I mean, he describes they gave him some antidepressants and anti-anxiety medication for quite a while after this. There's a fragility about him, and he's clearly been damaged by this experience and just by being there in a prison for so long. But he has a strength and an inner strength that's really exceptional. Some of it is actually faith. I mean, he's a very religious man. And one of the specific things that Rumsfeld required was that he not be allowed to pray, which, of course, is also illegal. But that was very difficult for him. And his faith has been important to him, and he's held on to it. And he just has some kind of an inner strength that he's maintained throughout this whole time, so that when he gets out, and we're going to get him out somehow, sooner rather than later, I hope, he will have the difficulties someone has who's been in jail a long time, but he will be okay.
I've never met him, but I can tell you that the qualities that I discovered in the manuscript that I think would be sustaining if he were in that situation. One is his tremendous curiosity. It's just incredibly curious. There's a great scene early on when he's, you know, when the plane lands in Guantanamo, he's one of 35 detainees who are in processed on August 5th, 2002, and they drag him off this freezing cold plane. They've been there for 30 hours, and they throw him in these trucks, you know, and these guards are just barking orders at him, sit down, da-da-da-da-da-da. And one of the guards says, do not talk. And another guard says, no talking. You know, and in the middle of what must be extreme agony, he says, they give the same order two different ways. That's interesting. You know, and it's like, so that kind of mind that pulls you out of yourself, you know, and I came to think of it, I was a classics major, and I came to think of there was a very Homeric kind of quality to for the scope of his epic, but also he has a vocabulary that's about the size of Homer's vocabulary, and he repeats some things, like in every cell that he's in, he has a thin, worn, 100-year-old mattress, like these kind of formulaic phrases. And he often drowns in his dreams, as he says. You know, he has a way of kind of moving into his imagination or outside of himself is one thing. And then he just has this tremendous empathy, you mm-hmm. know. And it just as and for me, I think the most breathtaking moments when I first went through the manuscript were just these incredible sketches that he would have of people. And, you know, the one that I remember most vividly early when he's thrown in this jail in Senegal. He has a cellmate who's a poor, hapless stowaway. This guy's been trying to get on a ship and get to Europe, you know, and he keeps getting caught and he keeps getting sent back to Africa. And he has this incredible exchange with this guy in this cell, just a young man who dreams of going to Europe to work. And it's just like, you know, in this book, which could be a litany of complaints, it could be an angry diatribe against the United States, you know, it was important to him to acknowledge this, you know, interesting doomed dreamer that he just met for a couple days in a cell in Senegal.
I want to ask two last questions and then open it up for the audience to ask questions. The first is about the process of editing the book. How much editing was required? How did you deal with all of the redactions that were there?
I mean, you know, it felt like very little editing to me. This came to me fully realized. The order has been changed a little bit because Muhammadu started the story at the moment that he is rendered from Jordan to Bagram. And I think he starts it there purposefully because that's the moment that he becomes fully under the control of the United States. And so that's where he starts his story. And it goes, he writes chronologically up until more or less the moment of the writing, 2004, 2005. And then he goes back and he starts two or three more times, working his way back to this first time he comes to be interrogated by the US, which is this trip back from Canada to Senegal. So there was reordering to move that forward. And then, you know, it's his fourth language. So, you know, I knew that my general instructions were to do what every editor does for a writer, which is, you know, what I hope my editors do for me, which is to eliminate my many embarrassing mistakes, more than he makes, by the way, you know, and things like that. And, you know, then there was the question of the redactions, and redactions were a challenge. And redactions are a challenge because, you know, remember, these are the fingerprints of censorship, right? And censorship is at the core of Muhammadu's story. It's at the core of Guantanamo. This place was invented to be a secret space. It was a secret space in order for torture to happen and then to cover up torture and to prevent accountability for torture. You know, and so the black bar redactions, 2,600 of them, are like the last vestiges of that censorship regime. And for Muhammadu, I mean, I think they harm his text in two significant ways that I struggled with a lot. The first is that he is, extremely open and honest and transparent about his own case. You know, every allegation that you've ever heard about Muhammadu Slahi, he talks about in his book. You know, he wants us to know, you know, that he was questioned about these things and he had answers. And that now some of those things are redacted in a way that looks like something's being concealed, but it's important to remember that's the government that's concealing it, not Muhammadu. And then the other thing is it just harms this basic ethic that he has as a writer of trying to distinguish people as individuals. You know, he wants us to meet these people as individuals, and it's difficult to know if interrogator on page 35 is interrogator on page 225, you know? So that was a real challenge. But generally, as I said, the process was one of just learning to trust him and really listen to him and try to follow the narrative that he was telling.
My other question, Nancy, is for you. One of the most stunning things about this is it was written in 2005. We're now in 2015. He's remained in Guantanamo for the last 10 years. Could you quickly describe what's gone on the last 10 years and where it is right now?
Sure, and it can be quick because not much has happened. We filed the petition for a writ of habeas corpus, which just means, in non-legal terms, that you're going to the court and saying, I've been held illegally, let me out. And that's what the petition asks for. And we went to the district court in Washington, D.C., and although this was written in 2005, there were a lot of things that had to happen and the Supreme Court had to rule before we could actually get to court. We had a hearing in 2010. Muhammadu testified with closed circuit television from Guantanamo. So the judge heard him testify and listened to him and listened to the government cross-examine him and found that the government did not have evidence to keep him. And all the government needed was just a little evidence. This isn't proof beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal case. A petition for a writ of habeas corpus, as we know, is a civil case. And so the government just needs to tip the balance a little bit. And the judge found they couldn't do that and ordered him released, 2010. The Obama administration had a plan at that time, and Salahi's was one of the cases, there were three of them, to go to the Court of Appeals and convince the Court of Appeals that the standard for who was part of al-Qaeda should be a looser and broader standard. And they convinced the court of that. So the standard changed, and the Court of Appeals sent it back to the district court and said, now under our new, broader standard that almost nobody can meet, We want you to reconsider this case. And we have sat in the court waiting for the next hearing, which we believe we would still win. And that's all that's happened. So if the Obama administration wants to close Guantanamo, they can stop fighting the habeas case of Mohamedou and others. They could just stop fighting it, and that would be the end for him, and he could go home. The other thing that is now happening is they have what they call periodic review boards. This is a new concept. It's not a real trial. There's not really due process, but it is a way to try to get people out, and we will have one of those, and that's another opportunity. But in the meantime, he just sits there. Every day is Groundhog Day for him. And he talks about that. Every day is the same. The days just go on and go on and go on because nothing really is happening.
With that, why don't we open for questions? And they're going to come with the microphones. And let me just ask that please make it a question and not a statement. And we want to get in as many questions as possible. So if you'd be relatively brief with your questions, that would be appreciated.
Excellent presentation, I thank you. The question is, how much money has he made in this bestseller, and where has that money gone?
We've set up a trust for Mohamedou. This book just came out, so I wouldn't say that it's made a lot of money. We've set up a trust for him. And at his instruction, actually, some of the advance money has already gone to put one of his nephews in college. And he wants, next, there are two nieces who he wants to go to college. And if there's enough money, when everyone in his family has been educated, he wants to set up a foundation for teaching girls in Mauritania.
Can you speak to the redaction or censorship process? Have you seen the unredacted version? And what would stop us from getting it unredacted, since the author is hopefully will be freed and be available to fill in the blanks again?
Well, the government is responsible for the redactions. It took us 6 years of litigating with the government to finally get this book out in the form it came out. The government made the choices about redactions. I don't know which agencies made those redactions. Presumably, that's absolutely true. If Mohamedou gets out, he can say whatever he wants to say. And maybe there'll be another version of this book.
I hope so.
But at this point, that was the government's decision. They decided what was redacted. In 2012, I received a document from the government, 466 pages, handwritten, which, by the way, you can see. It's up on the Guardian's website, the GuantanamoDiary.com. You can see the whole thing. And that's what we received, with a letter from the government saying this is the form in which it can be released. And that's
and I should add here, one of the things that Larry does masterfully as the editor is write footnotes for the redaction, where to the best of his ability, he tries to give the reader a sense of what was in the redacted material. And you say that you did this without talking to the lawyers who had access to classified information.
No, I just used the declassified record. It's all in the public domain, and it's not trying to fill in redactions. It's only saying that, you know, the scene that he's describing here is described in this way in these declassified documents. And sometimes in those declassified documents, for example, they do disguise names and descriptions of people. But there will be his testimony before the Administrative Review Board, where he'll say, that day I was interrogated by two FBI guys and a guy from, you know, some other agency or something. And so that, you know, I'll just quote that information to read alongside of it. It's all there in the public record. So, you know, I think it's a record of the process that I went through as I was trying to piece this manuscript together, and the things that sort of helped me sort of organize things and figure out, you know, or come to some sense of maybe, you know, who was who and the characters who are moving through things. But I have absolutely no idea how right or wrong I am. Sometimes I'm pretty sure I'm right when they have a sentence that says, as Reza read before, I could not help breaking in redacted, you know, and I don't know what's wrong with me. Every time somebody says something nice to me, I cry. I imagine that word was tears, as preposterous as it is to think that the government might have redacted the word tears. But otherwise, you know, it's like I say, mostly what I'm trying to do is just narratively speaking, he's describing a scene that's described in this way. And it's worth looking at two major government reports that were released in 2008. One is the Department of Justice's Inspector General's report that was prompted by complaints from the FBI about torture in Guantanamo. And Mohamedou's case features quite prominently in there because the FBI was very upset about what was happening with him. And then the other one is the Senate Armed Services Committee report, which cites very specifically, as I said, you know, quotes from the interrogation plan, which includes the boat trip, which includes the fake letter from his mother, and then cites these memoranda for the record, like day-by-day accounts of the interrogators that line up, as I say, exactly with what Mohamedou's describing. And I think it's just important because you put this book out there and people are going to say, who is this guy and why are we supposed to believe what he says? I just thought it's really important that readers understand that there is, you know, this book is anchored in government documents that make very clear that what the story that he's telling is true.
Either, is there anything that we can do to help get your client out of Guantanamo, or can you imagine either a movie or a miniseries based on this book?
Miniseries.
Well, those are two very different things.
Actually, they may be interrelated.
Maybe they're interrelated. But the ACLU has on its website a petition that you can sign, and I'd encourage everyone in this room to sign, asking the military, the Department of Defense, to stop fighting against this habeas corpus petition and just stop. And if they stop, then we're back to the fact that Judge Robertson ordered him released, and if the government doesn't keep fighting it, he could go home. And that's the first thing you can do. The other thing is to talk to people about Guantanamo. Make sure Americans know that it's still open. I meet people all the time who say to me, didn't we close that? Or say, well, aren't they all terrorists? And so both of those things, we need to educate this country. As for the movie or miniseries, at this point we just have a book.
Yeah, excuse me. I have a brief question for Larry and then a comment to Larry and a brief question to the two lawyers on the stage. The Bob Barker who makes the Guantanamo uniforms, that's not the TV animal rights guy that many people in this room would recognize. It's like a state senator in North Carolina, but it's a different Bob Barker. My question for the two lawyers is, it's pretty well recognized that, you know, Bush and Cheney and their hench people are, you know, primarily responsible for this whole torture gulag. What I'm wondering, though, is if it turns out, you know, their denials notwithstanding, that leading congressional Democrats and heads on the intelligence committees were also briefed and signed off on this stuff, what level of legal liability would attach to them?
You want to answer that?
Sure. I believe that those who are responsible for the torture in Guantanamo and different camps should be criminally prosecuted. The Senate Intelligence Committee report that came out in December, the report that Larry did earlier, Jane Mayer's stunning book, The Dark Side, all document what happened. And it was shameful to see Dick Cheney then go on the news in December and say he would do it all over again. He and the others responsible feel criminally liable. Now, I don't want to give the Obama administration a pass on this either. As Nancy points out, the Obama administration fought against habeas corpus for her client and for others in Guantanamo. Also, I think progressives deserve some of the blame. I don't think that we've pressured the Obama administration regarding Guantanamo in the same way that we would pressure a Republican administration.
I agree. You know, and let me just add to that, we're signatories. The United States signed the Convention Against Torture. When the United States signs and ratifies a treaty, it becomes a law of the land. So it's the same as, you know, you can't drive through a red light. You can't violate the treaty. Well, that treaty requires that countries prosecute people who violate it and who torture, and that people who are tortured get damages. And we're obligated to do both, and we've done neither.
Absolutely true.
Thank you. I think it's easy to say we can blame Bush and Cheney for a lot of this, but I think the issue is far broader in the country. And my question is, what do you see in the American culture, in our civilization here, that the civilian leadership, with hundreds, if not possibly thousands of people, involved top to bottom in this 10-year, 15-year program, and in the military, hundreds, if not thousands, carrying it out? What is it about us that can carry on this kind of horrible activity?
Well, I mean, I have some pretty strong feelings about collective responsibility. You know, we can talk about, you know, the Obama administration, or we can say the Obama wants to close Guantanamo, but Congress is preventing him. But, you know, I think it's true that Congress is fearful that if they vote to close Guantanamo, they will be voted out of office. So I think ultimately there is a lot of collective responsibility that we all have to look at. And, you know, I think we have allowed this curtain of censorship to exist in these places. We haven't asked questions, and we haven't really dealt with the human cost of these things. And part of any reconciliation and accountability process is a storytelling process. And I think one of the amazing things about this book is it moves us into that realm for the first time. You know, two sets of voices have been systematically excluded from the conversation about the torture program. The voices of the victims, the people that we tortured, and the voices of the men and women who we put in the position of doing that. And what's amazing about this book is that we get both of them. We get both of those voices. And I think, you know, part of, we can talk about whether we need to prosecute, you know, the higher ups for these things. It's very difficult to do, but it's very difficult to do partly because it's hypocritical to do that unless we acknowledge the fact that we live in a country where the number of people who support torture continues to increase year by year by year, according to opinion polls. You know, how can that be? So I think we need to have an open conversation about how much we've sort of cheered this on or allowed this to happen. But we also have to, as part of that conversation, integrate these two groups of voices that we haven't heard before.
I totally agree, though I also want to answer the question in a slightly different way. After World War II, a social psychologist by the name of Stanley Milgram wanted to show there was something unique to the German psyche and authoritarianism that led to the atrocities of World War II. He devised the social science experiment where individuals would come in, they were told that they had to give electric shocks to people so as to teach them vocabulary words. And he believed that Germans would be more likely to follow the instructions to give shocks than others. He found that it wasn't the case. He found out that just random college students would give shocks even in the fatal range, even when the Confederate, who was supposed to be learning the words, was saying, stop, I'm going to have a heart attack, and things like that. I think it says something about people following orders that's very important. I think it says something that's universal, so it's not just about the United States. And what came across to me in this book is once the government decided the ends justify the means became horrendous. And those in Guantanamo believed they were serving a higher end, but once they were told they could torture, they tortured in the most sadistic and brutal and inhumane way. And that's the lesson I think that this story tells.
The question of torture was across all of Iraq and Afghanistan. And my question is this. Since the military justice system is used to cover up things like this. Would it be better if we took the entire military criminal justice system, removed it from the military, and brought it into the federal courts where all of us could see what was going on?
<That's> Nancy?
Well, there are two different things going on here. There's the military commissions at Guantanamo is a created court, literally created out of whole cloth. It is not it is not the military system, nor is it the federal justice system. The military courts are not so different from the federal courts. They have due process. They have the right to confrontation. They have the rules of evidence that we understand. That's not where the problem is. For Guantanamo, where, by the way, there have only been 10 prosecutions in total since 2002, and that's including the ones that are going on now, the seven that are going on now. There's only three who've been convicted. And as an aside, as somebody said, the best way to get out of Guantanamo is to get convicted, because two of those three people who were convicted are now home and have been told that they shouldn't have been convicted in the first place. But the military commission, the trials in Guantanamo are not really trials. They're just a made up out of whole cloth kangaroo court. The military system of justice is very similar to the federal system. So I don't think that's really where the problem is. Do you agree?
Completely. I want to thank all of you for coming tonight. I ask we all thank Larry and Nancy for just a terrific discussion.
Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.